Radio Days is the 15th film written and directed by Woody Allen, first released in 1987. Radio Days marks the culmination of everything Woody Allen had done up to that point. Featuring plenty of Allen's past cast, it mixes a European feel, directing flair, old-time entertainment, the documentary form, and something very American into a great film. Woody Allen narrates an almost biographical story about a child who grows up in the time of World War II, but falling in love with the stories on the radio. We follow the young boy Joe, played by Seth Green, and his charming, crazy family as their lives are connected to what they hear on the air. Welcome to the Woody Allen Pages podcast. This week we look at 1987's Radio Days, how it was conceived, how it was made, and how it mixes a bit of everything that makes Woody Allen great. Spoilers are everywhere, so watch the film and then come back.
Now, I love old radio stories, and I know a million of them. I've collected them down through the years, like a hobby. Anecdotes and gossip and inside stories about the stars. Plus, I recall so many personal experiences from when I grew up and listened to one show after another.
The 1930s to the 1950s was the golden age for radio. In America, it was the primary form of entertainment. There was no TV, no video games, and no TikTok. Everything was the radio. Pretty much all the entertainment and stories that we have today, there was a radio version of them. High-end dramas, news, celebrity shows, quiz shows, kids shows, all of them had a precedent from the radio days. Because of this, stars of the radio were the biggest stars of the day, and what happened on the radio was talked about by everyone. Of course, there was also the music. Those years between the world wars was a fascinating time for music. Jazz was spreading its wings, both into pop and into art. Big bands and orchestras supplied the glamour that so many were missing from their day-to-day lives. Crooners were singing for housewives. Early teen idols were singing to teenage girls. Swing bands, world music, early doo-wop, and all sorts of fun stuff could be heard on the radio. The music was where Allen started. He had an idea about picking out a bunch of songs that meant a lot to him and making a film about it. This is still part of the finished film, because Allen grew up in this radio era. He lived through it. But soon, Allen had so many stories, many of which were deeply personal, that the film became something else.
I don't know what to do, Rabbi. Every night he listens to the radio. I can't keep him away. I say go to the beach, play in the sun, get some fresh air. No. The Lone Ranger, the Shadow, the Masked Avenger.
This is not good. This boy needs discipline. Radio. It's all right once in a while. Otherwise, it tends to induce bad values, false dreams, lazy habits.
In this period, the mid-80s, Allen was also enthralled by European film and filmmakers. Federico Fellini in particular had influenced Allen in films like Stardust Memories and would go on to inspire films like Alice and Sweden Lowdown. The Fellini film that influenced this film was 1973's Amarcord. That film was a bitter look back at the childhood of Fellini and his friends in Italy. It's how they see the culture around them and the people in their world. In his film, Fellini was dealing with fascism. But Allen took that premise of dramatizing a childhood and put a personal touch to his radio stories. Many of the stories or the people are based on real events or real individuals. As a pseudo-history of radio at the time, this film is pretty good. I imagine it could be shown in a history of radio class. Orson Welles did indeed put on a production of War of the Worlds on radio that started with a news broadcast about an alien invasion in 1938. How many people were fooled has been questioned, but certainly some people thought it was real. And why wouldn't they, as it was presented as real, and there was no other media like TV or Google to check against? Allen doesn't use the real recording here, but a recreation.
Oh, Sydney, this is our first date together.
Aw, B, you know how I feel about you.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. A state of emergency has been declared by the President of the United States. We're switching live to Wilson's Glen, New Jersey, where the landing of hundreds of unidentified spacecraft has now been officially confirmed as a full-scale invasion of the Earth by Martians.
I don't know if there was ever a case where criminals broke into a house and won a radio quiz, but those call-up quiz shows, like the one called Guess That Tune that opens the film, were certainly real. The most popular was one called Pot of Gold, where the host would call the public after picking their number out of the phone book for a chance to win prizes.
5%.
Hello? You, Mr. Marty Needleman, have been chosen from the telephone book to guess that tune.
Anyone who says superheroes are a fad hasn't realised that they've been around since at least the 40s. There were lots of superhero serials on the radio back in the day. Superman and Batman have never left the culture, but popular names like Flash Gordon, Green Hornet, the Lone Ranger, and the Shadow were some of the biggest names in the business. Joe's favourite, the Masked Avenger, looks like a mix of a lot of them.
My own personal favourite show was something called the Masked Avenger, who I fantasised was a cross between Superman and Cary Grant.
Breakfast with Irene and Roger was based on a similar show called Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. It was hosted by Dorothy Colmar, a popular reporter, and her husband, Richard Colmar, who was an actor and a producer on Broadway. From 1945 till 1963, they broadcast a breakfast show from their New York home, at first an elegant apartment in Park Avenue and later a brownstone in East Village. They talked about the premieres they went to, the hip Manhattan club life, and celebrities they rubbed shoulders with. And they were served breakfast at the time by a butler. It was extremely elegant and popular enough that it produced many spin-offs around America.
My mother, for instance, never missed her favourite show, Breakfast with Irene and Roger.
Good morning, darling. Pass the orange juice, please.
There you go. That was quite an opening night we attended last night, wasn't it?
Yes, wasn't it divine? Everyone was there, from Rodgers and Hart to Cole Porter. Yes.
Tito Puente. The real musician Tito Puente plays the bandleader in The King Cole Room with singer Denise Dumont. It's inspired by the bandleader Xavier Cugat, whose music Alan has used before. He performed regularly at New York clubs like these ones with singer Lena Romay. Puente is even holding a chihuahua like the real Cugat used to do. Sports announcer Bill Kearns is based on the sports announcer Bill Stearns. Even the baseball player story that he tells, the one that loses a leg, and then more, is based on a real player named Monty Stratton. Like the fictional Kirby Kyle, he lost his leg in a hunting accident in 1938, but continued to play in the minor leagues.
The bullet entered his leg. 2 days later, it was amputated. They said he would never pitch again.
But the next season, he was back. He had one leg. But he had something more important. He had heart.
The ventriloquist is also based in truth. There were several famous ventriloquists on the radio in these days, like Edgar Bergen. He established himself on vaudeville first, but then had a radio show in 1936, which was a hit. Yes, of course, there was no puppet on the radio, and the skill of watching someone pull off ventriloquism live is missing. But the show was funny and fun enough that people liked it anyway.
He's a ventriloquist on the radio. How do you know he's not moving his lips?
Who cares? Leave me alone.
The Marital Counselor is based on John J. Anthony, the host of The Goodwill Hour. He would give marriage advice to couples on air, and he was hugely popular in the 1930s.
My mother and father loved to hear the show where ordinary people were helped with their personal problems.
6 years ago, his mother came to live with us, and she won't leave, and he won't throw her out.
Claire, how can I throw my own mother out?
What do you mean?
No,
you grab her by
please.
The throat and throw her out.
Oh,
that's
just like
her
that.
Out on the
just
street.
Like that.
Yes,
grab her
that's
by the throat,
right. Jessica, go out of the street.
A real girl named Kathy Fiscus fell down a well in April of 1949. It was a national story, and one that got lots of national TV coverage. Sure, kids had died from similar accidents before, but suddenly there was live coverage thanks to advances in TV. For Alan, he followed the story on the radio and set his version a few years earlier. But those days when an entire nation was following the fate of a little girl down a well was real. And sadly, the real-life Kathy Fiscus, like Polly in this story, died.
We will continue to broadcast live from the scene of the accident and bring you details as they unfold. I'm sure all Americans listening to their radios everywhere are praying for Polly Phelps and the Phelps family.
And then there's all the stuff about World War II. There were rumors of U-boats making it all the way to New York. Kids were collecting scrap metal. And yes, the villains in action shows became Japanese or German pretty much overnight. But this isn't just the history of radio. Alan managed to weave the radio history around this family and bring it to life as if you were there with them. So it's not just about the War of the Worlds broadcast. It's that the War of the Worlds broadcast broke up a date for Aunt B, or that the Pearl Harbor attack disrupted Sally's acting debut, or the kids were on top of a building looking for German planes, which led them to being peeping Toms.
Who is Pearl Harbor?
I can't imagine a version of this film with just the radio history stories. The family are at the heart of it. Alan himself lived a life almost exactly like Joe's, the centre of the story. Joe lives in Brooklyn, in the same part of Brooklyn where Alan grew up, in those row houses near Rockaway Beach. Alan said that people thought the reveal of Joe's home was a joke because of how run down it looks, like a repeat of Annie Hall's House Under the Roller Coaster gag. But Alan meant it straight. Like Joe, Alan also grew up with a lot of wider family around. Alan has talked about the parade of aunts and extended family that lived in their house. He also had a younger sister born in these years, just like Joe does. Of course, it's all narrated by an older version of Joe, voiced by Woody Allen, eliminating any doubt about the connection. But making it not autobiographical means he has the freedom to play around with the story. And stories can be open-ended or played for jokes. The family stuff pairs well with the bigger stories that captured the nation. The funny little fights and the quirks of the family make the film for me. Like Uncle Abe's love of fish, or the weird grandparents, or the constantly bickering parents.
Wait a minute! Are you telling me you think the Atlantic is a greater ocean than the Pacific?
No, have it your way. The Pacific is greater.
There's a moment where Joe remembers the only time he saw his parents kiss, and it is heartbreakingly beautiful. Or how Joe finds out what his dad does for a living. Those little moments that kids remember that no one else notices. And none of this has anything to do with the radio.
I can never hear this song without recalling my parents' anniversary. It was the only time I ever saw them kiss. It was a very wonderful memory.
I imagine most of it comes from real life. Like the story of the one neighbor who doesn't fast and leaves the radio on during Yom Kippur. Or the man who goes crazy and runs down the street with a knife, which is so crazy it has to have some element of truth. Later, Alan would say that he saw this family as cartoons. They were just big exaggerations. But I also don't think Alan, in 50 films, has ever portrayed a family in a sweeter way than this. It's nice that his cynicism took a back seat for at least one film.
Besides, I knew that no one would believe me.
Radio Days is a lot of stories, and it doesn't always feel like it's building up to anything. The important exceptions are Sally and Aunt B, the two most important characters, other than Joe. They give the film an important through line. Sally, played by Mia Farrow, represents the radio side of it. She was based on Hedda Hopper. Hopper would ultimately turn out to be this awful woman, but like Sally, her lack of talent didn't seem to harm her as she fell from job to job. She was a runaway who became a failed actress, who ultimately became a gossip columnist. She had her own radio show from 1939. In other films, Hopper or Hopper surrogates have been played by Helen Mirren, Tilda Swinton, and Judy Davis. Alan gives her the film's funniest moments. She's caught up in a whirlwind of creepy men and bad jobs. She goes from the ridiculous, like being the witness to a mob shooting, to even more ridiculous, like the laxative jingle. But some diction lessons changes everything for her. And by the end of the film, she gets to sit at the table with the people that she used to serve. It's a ridiculous story, but the point of the film are these ridiculous tales. I don't know if we are supposed to love Sally. We feel bad for her at times, but her life is more interesting than her. We enjoy seeing this world through her eyes. She's flawed, but I guess that's what makes her interesting and three-dimensional. And we do want to see what happens to her. I guess what Alan's trying to say is she's a product of the times. There's always people who want to be stars, and what happened to wannabe stars in the 30s is what happened to Sally.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. Yeah, that's right. I can act, too. Yeah. I just do anything to get on radio. I'd be happy to give the weather report or interview people. I think I'm a natural.
Oh.
I'm a great dancer.
But you can dance on radio.
I know, because they can't see you.
Madonna mia.
I know.
Oh, Madonna mia, ma queste sono cose da pazzi. Wait, come here, Rocco. Come here.
What, Mom?
Come here. I got to tell you something. You come over here with me. Vieni, Rocco. Vieni. Listen to me. You don't have to fear and worry about that girl because she's not too fierce up here. She wouldn't make no trouble.
Yeah, well, I feel sorry.
Then there's Aunt B. She's the one we do love. She's equally cartoonish as Sally, but our heart yearns for her because she just wants love and it's so relatable. And unlike Sally, nothing goes right for her, no matter how hard she tries. She goes through a series of men, each of whom are no good for her. Alan could have played it more comically, but he plays it pretty straight, and so it breaks our hearts. That's the beauty of this apparent comedy, how often it's heartbreaking. Alan uses a little throwaway detail about Bea on her first date, that she hides her glasses on dates because she's embarrassed about them. Oh, and it just makes us feel so strongly for her. It also hurts that ultimately Bea doesn't get a happy ending. When Bea finally meets a kind of good man, we hear in voiceover that he never leaves his wife. Alan, or Joe, doesn't show us that ending. He just shows us the happy times of Bea and her beau dancing.
She and Cy seemed very much in love, and she seemed happy, but it was not to be. Because after a week, Cy did not leave his wife and children, nor did he after 2 weeks, nor ever. And as the year came to a close, Aunt Bea would soon be back to her old dreams of finding a true love.
The film ends with some of my favourite Woody Allen moments ever. There's the extended Polly Phelps sequence. Alan's focus isn't on the girl or the rescue. Instead, we focus on dozens of people in different walks of life listening to the radio. It rightly feels like the climax of the film. Everyone has been brought together by the radio. Alan's narration completely disappears in this section. It doesn't need explaining or spelling out. And the sequence ends with Dad hugging Joe.
Emergency workers and neighbors outside Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, are working diligently to locate and remove an 8-year-old girl who has fallen down a well. Polly Phelps fell down the well while playing with friends and has been lodged at the bottom since 12 noon.
Then it's followed by the various radio stars we saw previously, wondering about their own future on a Manhattan rooftop. I don't know why it's so fun to see all these characters together. It's just a trick of scheduling to see Bill Baxter and the Masked Avenger and everyone back, but it works. We love to see them when they turn up. I like that Sally leads them to the roof, recalling her earlier adventure. It's a nice payoff for her. But then the stars talk and reminisce. No one talks like this in real life. The dialogue becomes philosophical and big. It's a very knowing goodbye from these superstars of yesterday. Alan even shows them heading for the door one final time.
Another year is passing.
1944 turns out well.
They pass so quickly. Where do they all go?
So quickly. And then we get old. We never knew what any of it was about.
That's right. I wonder if future generations will even hear about us. It's not likely. After enough time, everything passes. I don't care how big we are or how important in their lives.
And then finally, the film ends with Woody Allen's own goodbye to the era in voiceover. It's not long, not sentimental, and not a stirring speech. It's also not a joke or a gag. Alan just says that these people meant a lot to him, and then we're done.
I never forgot that New Year's Eve, when Aunt Bea awakened me to watch 1944 come in. And I've never forgotten any of those people or any of the voices we used to hear on the radio. Although the truth is, with the passing of each New Year's Eve, those voices do seem to grow dimmer and dimmer.
Of course, we know the real ending, that this whole world of radio gave way to television, mass media, the internet, and TikTok. And those stars did fade. They were fading in 1987 when this film came out, and almost 40 years later, who even knows these stories? These stories are creeping into being a century old. Alan pays tribute to the era beautifully, and if he made a lot of the details up, he's emotionally honest. Alan is showing us how it felt to be there, and that is what keeps the film great today, because the emotional honesty hasn't dated. And there's just so much film here. So many characters with over 100 cast members, so many funny lines, so many tender moments. In fact, one of the great things about this film is how there's a little bit of everything and it's played for contrast. It pairs the upper-class celebrity glamour with the simple working-class family. There's big world-changing moments and the smallest bit of sweetness between two people. There's the deepest of beauty and irrational silliness.
No, no, no.
The cannons roar. The cannons roar.
The cannons roar. Hark, I hear the cannons roar. Is it the king approaching?
Alan said that he knows all these stories and that he collected them over the years. But perhaps the craziest thing of all is that he kind of decided to film every single damn one of them. The great thing about trying to tell the story of the production of this film is that someone already did it. There is a book called On Location, written by Thierry de Navacelle, which covers the making of the film. Before the era of behind-the-scenes special features on DVDs, it was kind of the holy bible on how Alan worked. The writer chose a great film to cover, because Radio Days was one of Alan's most ambitious films in the 80s, and the 80s was one of his golden eras. With all those speaking parts and dozens of locations, it's like two or three times the production work of other Alan films. And this was deliberate too. Hannah and Her Sisters, the film before this, was set in contemporary New York and shot in a lot of existing apartments and was all about the acting. Alan, who likes to react against his last film, wanted to make something big with sets in a studio with lots of people and costumes and music. He wanted to do something bigger, and this would end up being his biggest film to date, and probably until he topped it with Celebrity 11 years later. The film could have been even bigger than it was. Many scenes were shot and cut. He was able to do it because of the way he worked. His entire crew were on retainers and worked just for Alan. This included cinematographer Carlo De Palma, working on his second Alan film. Alan himself was just constantly shooting, so there was always work. And his continued deal with Orion meant he didn't need a green light to work. He just delivered a film a year, and that was that. So for many months, Alan just kept shooting. He'd write new scenes and shoot those. He'd rewrite scenes that weren't working and shoot those. He probably shot around twice as much film as he actually needed. If there's one Woody Allen film that I wish Alan would release deleted scenes from, it is this one. So much of the stuff that was cut that we know about sounds fun. There was a sequence with a Houdini-style escape artist. There was more of Sally being a serious actress and failing. The actual Whiz Kids radio show was shot. There was more radio shows, and there was more of the radio shows we still see. It's interesting that it's the radio stuff that was cut. In reshoots, Alan filmed more with the family and beefed up that part of the story. Alan took everything and, with the help of editor Susan E. Morse, found the film in the edit.
I compromised when I picked Martin. I mean, I wanted someone tall and handsome and rich. 3 out of 3 I gave up.
There was just enough buildings and locations from the period that could be dressed to make it feel like the 30s and 40s by the time of the 80s. Alan had tried to shoot Manhattan in a vintage period for Broadway Danny Rose, but too much had changed on the streets. Here, he doesn't even try, and made sure that simple street corners in Rockaway were dressed to make it look like the 30s. Newly made vintage street signs, vintage cars, and people with old-fashioned clothes complete the illusion. There's a wonderful shot of Playland Amusement Park. Alan used it in other period films like The Purple Rose of Cairo and Sweden Lowdown. But it still looked like it did in the 30s, with a few recreations of period-style advertising boards completing the scene. And it's still around today. Alan even shot a few scenes there for 2017's Wonder Wheel. The incredibly elegant King Cole Room, where Sally works, maintained its Art Deco splendour in the 80s. It opened in 1935, and at the time that this film was set, it didn't actually allow women in there. It was located in the prestigious St. Regis Hotel on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. It now looks completely different, and it's a bar.
I used to work in this place. Now I'm here with, of all people, the Masked Avenger.
Beware, evildoers, wherever you are!
There's the Radio City Music Hall in the heart of Manhattan. We see the Art Deco interiors for which it's famous. I imagine trying to transform the exterior around it, which is in the heart of Midtown Manhattan, would be impossibly expensive CGI, even today. But it was built in 1932, just a few years before our story is set.
My most vivid memory, connected with an old radio song, I associate with the time that Aunt Bee and her then-boyfriend Chester took me into New York to the movies. It was the first time I'd ever seen the Radio City Music Hall, and it was like entering heaven. I just never saw anything so beautiful in my life.
The Automat, the cool little Art Deco food place with the little windows where you served yourself, was a craze in New York at the time. Alan and the team managed to shoot their scene at Horn and Hardat, pretty much the last one in the city, which is long gone now. The family house interior looks fantastic. It's a set with all the vintage furniture and appliances. There were lots of sets, actually. The rooftop where Sally gets stuck on was also a set. And I love those advertising signs on that rooftop. A lot of it was made at the Kaufman Astoria Studios, a relatively new film studio in Queens, New York. It was refurbished and expanded from an older studio in the early 80s and was the largest East Coast film studio at the time. Alan would shoot dozens more films there.
It's a business failure. Yeah, he never finishes what he starts. We're forced to live with my relatives, and thank God for them. Mm-hmm. And I could have married Sam Slotkin.
Sam Slotkin's dead.
Yes, but while he was alive, he was working.
The set designer was Santo Loquasto, who worked as Alan's costume designer since Stardust Memories. Graduating to doing the entire set, he would work with Alan for decades, working on every Woody Allen American film ever since. The fine details of the dirty dishes in the family home to the right cigarettes sold at the King Cole Room are all the work of Santo. He was rightly nominated for an Academy Award for his work here. And the costumes are incredible. Like the story, it has to span the lower class family and the kids in school up to the celebrities and the upper crust dressed in tuxedos and elegant dresses. All of that is the work of Alan's longtime costume designer, Jeffrey Kurland. He won a BAFTA for his efforts in this film. Alan's work as a director really shines here. On top of assembling that killer team, the film is constantly interesting without being confusing. And even with no ticking clock to keep you invested, you're never bored. There's dozens and dozens of incredible shots. The entire Polly Phelps sequence just looks fantastic. There's a sea of spotlights and car lights. Everyone's in silhouette, adding to the uncertainty. Then all the vignettes of people listening in on those immaculate sets or doing interesting things, staged in interesting way. The camera leans in or zooms out. It's just full of ideas. I love the shot of Bill Kearns from The Worm's Eye View. That faraway shot of Joe walking along Playland where he looks so small. And when the mother talks about people during an air raid and always sees the night sky and the spotlights. And then there's Sally in that huge set singing for the soldiers. There's that lovely moment when children clap when it's announced they have a substitute teacher, which always makes me laugh.
Good morning, class. I'd like you to know that your regular teacher, Mrs. Nash, is ill today, and you will have a substitute teacher.
Yeah! Or the dad and Uncle Abe joining in on Cousin Ruthie's song. I'm kind of just listing things now, but there's so much on the list I've barely scratched the surface. But I'll leave you with an example of another small thing that Alan does to make the film shine. There's a small scene when the older Joe is talking about songs and Aunt Bee is sitting on the steps in front of their house. The narration never refers to it, but suddenly a mass of kids run into the house. And then there's a beat, and then a moment later, they rush back out carrying food and snacks. It's a sweet moment that Alan casually throws in. Surely by now, Alan is just having fun as a director, having been one for 18 years. And he's just casually sprinkling in magical moments everywhere. Where do we begin with the cast? There are over 100 speaking roles in the final film, and many more were cut. Alan and casting director Juliet Taylor had a lot of people to hire. So not surprisingly, they went to the pool of talented actors they had already worked with. Dozens of actors in this film appear in other Woody Allen films around this time. One exception is Seth Green, who plays Joe. Green had already had a few film roles, as well as some ads under his belt by the time of Radio Days. But he has to hold the screen and be confident, and does so pretty well. No wonder he became a big star of the Austin Powers films and the Buffy series and so much more. There's been a few actors who have played Alan as a child, and I think Green is easily the best of the lot.
What do you do, Dad?
It's none of your business.
All my friends know what their dads do for a living.
Don't you have any homework?
Julie Kavner will be forever known as Marge Simpson. She returns from the recent Hannah and Her Sisters and would work with Alan again several more times. For my money, this is her best role with Alan. She is sweet, smart, and we feel for her as the mother. She gets to have some wonderful jokes, and it's just a beautifully written role that she plays well.
Yeah, well, I like to daydream, but I have my 2 feet firmly planted on my husband.
Joe's dad is played by Michael Tucker, returning from The Purple Rose of Cairo. He appeared in a million episodes of Law & Order and a lot of comedies. And like Kavner, he's well-classed as the normal, regular, schlubby dad. He is stern, but he's sweet.
Hey, quick, what's 1,754 divided into 13 million, huh?
Martin.
Yeah, this palooka can't even pass a simple arithmetic exam, you know?
And of course, there's Aunt Bee, played by Diane Wiest. She is on fire. She's able to just imbue Aunt Bee with loneliness and inner life when everything else is a cartoon. In terms of acting, she's the best in the film. And this comes just after she won her Academy Award for Hannah and Her Sisters. Sure, she's capable of so much more, but it's fun to see her play this one-note lonely spinster and knock it out of the park.
Hey, Tess? Tess, I can't decide if I should take my vacation on a cruise or go to the mountains. I mean, the men are richer on a cruise, but there's more of them in the resorts. What do you think, Tess?
Well, I met my husband at a mountain resort, so I advise you to go on a cruise.
The rest of the family are cartoons, likely cast because they looked right more than anything else. Uncle Abe is played by Josh Mostel, the son of Zero Mostel. Joy Newman, who played Cousin Ruthie, has no other credits to her name. Aunt Seal is played by Renee Lippin, who appeared in some other comedies, but this is her most significant role.
Oh, Abe, how come you never take me to the Copacabana or El Morocco?
Take the gas pipe.
I suppose you would have been happier married to Rita Hayworth.
You gotta ask.
Believe me, Abe, those show business celebrities get divorced every 6 weeks, but we're together forever.
I may take the gas pipe.
Wallace Shawn is back from Manhattan. Alan does a similar joke from that film. Shawn looks funny, and it's funny for him to play against type. I love the idea of Shawn being a superhero, but Shawn, who would work with Alan again many times, can more than easily play heroic.
Beware, evildoers, wherever you are!
Of course, Mia Farrow is back. I'm not sure if this is her best role for Woody, but she definitely gets to show off her versatility here. In particular, I don't think she's ever been funnier than the hapless Sally. It's a gem of a role, and she makes it her own. Apparently, she tried several voices for Sally. Her vocal ability is underrated, and she also gets to sing a song. Although Sally's voice is one of the worst things I've ever heard.
You know, it's not even midnight, and I'm drunk.
Seen the roof of this place?
It has the most marvelous view of the city, really.
How do you know the roof?
I was up there once when I worked here. The circumstances were quite different. Why don't we go up there and see it? Would you like to? Come with me.
And then there's 100 interesting cameos. The host of Guess That Tune is Don Pardo, the veteran announcer of SNL, and much more. Sportscaster Bill Kearns is played by former sportscaster Guy LeBeau. Danielle Ferland, who played a child singer, is in her first screen role here. She originated the Red Riding Hood role in Sondheim's Into the Woods. She would work with Alan again in Mighty Aphrodite and Wonder Wheel. The latter was 30 years on from this film. Kitty Carlisle is the Maxwell House singer. She starred in Marx Brothers films in the 30s and dated George Gershwin. In real life, she was probably one of those hobnobbing celebrities in the 30s that would have hung out at the King Cole Room. Larry David is here as a neighbour. He's only seen from afar. You can barely recognize him. He would work with Alan again in New York Stories and Whatever Works.
Hey, listen.
What the hell are you doing?
Turn off the radio. Huh? We're praying in
praying?
Here. Yes.
What good is that? You should be working. Working for the benefit of your fellow man.
It is a sin to work today.
It's a sin not to work.
Oh, are you gonna pay please. For expense? Today is the most holy day. Can't you please turn off the radio?
And there are so many others. Kenneth Mars and William H. Macy, both of whom would return for Shadows and Fog. Danny Aiello and Jeff Daniels, who returned from The Purple Rose of Cairo. Daniels, interestingly, has the same last name here as he does for his character in The Purple Rose of Cairo, Baxter. Tony Roberts gets a role as a game show announcer. Jackson Beck, who did the voiceover for Alan's first film Take the Money and Run, is back doing narration for the Polly Phelps section. And then there's Diane Keaton. No lines, no acting. She just gets to look radiant and sing a love song like the superstar that she was. It's funny because this film doesn't have a big set-piece ending or a big kiss at the end or any of the traditional high points that comes at the end of a film. So Alan's set-piece, the big fight scene or car chase or kiss, is just putting Diane Keaton on screen. And it works for me.
Under stars, chilled by the winter, under an August moon, burning above, you'd be so nice, you'd be paradise to come home to and love.
Finally, Woody Allen as the narrator ties the film together. We never talk about it, but his distinctive voice has such personality. That's why his stand-up albums are classics and he does his own audiobooks. I wonder if anyone watches this film and wonders who the narrator is, because Alan doesn't give himself the narrator credit.
That's how I found out what my father did for a living. For some strange reason, he was ashamed of it. And even then, he didn't admit it. It didn't bother me one bit, though. I loved him. In fact, I gave him the biggest tip he got all day.
It is surprising that, in retrospect, this film is really not about music. The music is just what happened to be on the radio. We don't learn much about the history of music at this time. It's not about Cole Porter or those big bands. When Alan talks about songs, he mostly doesn't mention the song names or artists. I guess they aren't the point. The writers and the performers of the music are one side of life that this story doesn't tell. Alan focuses on how the music made people feel.
This girl singing used to be a favorite at my house, one of many. Now it's all gone, except for the memories.
The finished film has over 40 pieces of music used, and music permeates the film in discussion as well. All the music on the radio are existing recordings from the time. There are songs performed for the film, like the band from Guess That Tune or the King Cole Room, as well as Diane Keaton and Mia Farrow's numbers. Music fills the film. Some originals were written by Alan's regular composer at this time, Dick Hyman. Most notably, Get Regular with Relax and the other bits of radio show themes, like the Masked Avenger theme.
Get regular with Relax. Start every day the Relax way. Your system will feel so great you'll want to relax on the top of the Empire State. Get regular with Relax. Start every day the Relax way. When your tummy's not so hot, remember X marks the spot. Get regular with Relax. The Relax way.
The commercially released soundtrack was just a single album with 12 songs. They probably couldn't justify the cost of a double album, let alone a triple, which is what it really should be. There were 16 songs on the CD at least. It's a real shame that that Diane Keaton number isn't available on anything. The opening credit song is The Flight of the Bumblebee. It's a strange choice as it's not a tune you'd immediately associate with the 30s or 40s. It's a short classical interlude written by Russian composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov in 1899. It's been used in a million chase scenes, and as an exciting stage setter, it works here. But this recording is by Harry James, and it's from 1939, and it was the theme for the Green Hornet radio show. So Alan probably just recalls it from the era. It wasn't included on the soundtrack. Radio Days was released in 1987 through Orion Pictures, their sixth film with Alan. It came right after the masterpiece that was Hannah and Her Sisters. The man was just on a roll in the 80s. Because no one had much screen time, this film missed out on any acting nominations. Alan did get his annual screenplay nomination. Released after Hannah and Her Sisters, which was greeted with so much acclaim, Radio Days kinda got lost. It was just another really brilliant Woody Allen film in a run of really brilliant films. Maybe it was too cartoonish for some people. There's no drama or devastating statements about human life. There's no awards bait acting performances. There's no deep dissection on desire and romance. There's no modern New York. But sometimes I think Radio Days is my favourite Woody Allen film. I just love it so much. I mean, yes, Annie Hall and Manhattan mean the world to me. But as I get older, it's films like Radio Days and Vicky Cristina Barcelona that fit for me. Some of these films get better with age, and Radio Days is one of them. It's the mix that gets me. The funny mixed with sadness and nostalgia. The big set pieces and costumes mixed with the family. The Fellini and European influence on a story that couldn't be more American. I think I love this film because there's so much to love. It's like a perfect salad. Everything is mixed together just right.
Seal! I got fish!
It's also an incredible achievement in terms of production. As a story, it's incredibly poignant and memorable, with Sally, Bee, and Joe. As a piece of history, it makes you feel like you've lived it, as opposed to learned it. I can make all these important points and say that this is an important film. I would say it's a masterpiece. It's top five Woody Allen. That, for me, is all true. But overwhelmingly, this film just makes me happy. It's just joy. And through the years, that has never faded.
You should wake him up to see the searchlights.
No, let him sleep. He's got school.
So beautiful. Boy, what a world. Could be so wonderful if it wasn't for certain people.
Some fun facts about Radio Days. The family doesn't have a last name, but according to the script, they are the Jackhammer family. Diane Keaton's unnamed singer also has a name in the script, and it's Monica Charles. And finally, it wasn't enough that Allen made his biggest film to date. Allen also managed to make another film. 1987 saw the release of this film and September. Allen just didn't stop.
Pay more attention to your schoolwork and listen to the radio.
You always listen to the radio.
It's different. Our lives are ruined already. You still have a chance to grow up and be somebody.
Okay, thanks for listening to this episode of the Woody Allen Pages podcast. And that's the last of the films. It went by too fast. At the end of the podcast here, I talk about support, and there is really a great no-cost way to support the podcast and the website, and that is simply leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or sharing the podcast with friends and just simply telling people about it on social media. The world is a numbers game, and helping to spread the word and leaving good reviews is paramount. It doesn't cost anything, and it really does help a lot. So please, log into Apple Podcasts, leave me a review, and go onto your social media and tell someone about one of the episodes. What's your favourite film? Maybe just share the Annie Hall episode. Everything helps. There's other ways to support, of course. There's the Patreon, and there's also a tipping service called Buy Me a Coffee. There's merch that you can buy, like books and t-shirts. There's links to all that and more in the description. Also, check out the Woody Allen Pages website and all the links to me on social media. There's also ways to get in contact with me as well. Next week, we wrap season 3 with a look at Woody Allen the writer in a special episode.
What should I be thinking inside?
Think laxative.
Think thinks.